BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Richard Eyre, and I'm a theatre and film director. I'm nearly as old as King Lear, but I came to Shakespeare late. In fact, I was nearly 16 when I saw my first Shakespeare. It was Hamlet, a play I'd never even read. I felt something like the composer Berlioz seeing the same play in Paris when he didn't speak a word of English. Shakespeare, he said, falling thus unexpectedly upon me, dismayed and astounded me. I recognised true grandeur, true beauty, dramatic truth. I saw, I understood. I felt that I was really conscious of life and that I must now rise up and walk. I had a similar epiphany when I saw Peter Brook's production of King Lear with Paul Scofield a few years later. King Lear has become my favourite play of Shakespeare's, and I've directed it in the theatre with Ian Holm and on film with Anthony Hopkins. Unlike many of Shakespeare's plays, King Lear was published in a quarto edition 15 years before the first folio appeared in 1623. Published in Shakespeare's lifetime, the quarto text was probably compiled by actors who'd been in the play, and it's unlikely that the author was involved in its publication. The folio, on the other hand, was published 7 years after Shakespeare's death, with the involvement of two friends of his, using the original prompt books. Like all directors of King Lear, I picked and mixed between quarto and folio. There are many differences in the text between the two versions. The quarto lacks 100 lines, which are found in the folio, and the folio lacks 300 lines, which are found in the quarto. The oddest omission in the folio is a magnificent scene in which Lear, accompanied by his persistently loyal friend Kent, his godson Edgar, and the fool, his court jester, take refuge from a storm in a hut. The king stages a surreal trial of his elder daughters with his companions as judges. Then he falls asleep in exhaustion, and the fool slips into unconsciousness, dying, we can infer, from hypothermia. I didn't feel ready to direct the play until my daughter became an adult and my parents were dead. Why? Because it's all about the relationship between fathers and their children, and children and their fathers. There are two fathers, the king and his prime minister, Gloucester, and there are five children, Lear's three daughters, Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia, and Gloucester's two sons, Edgar, legitimate, and Edmund, illegitimate, who burns with a violent resentment of his brother. At the age of 80, King Lear decides to retire from office. He wants to be young again, with no cares or responsibilities. He's selfish, self-regarding, a lonely widower, and a remote ruler. He sees himself as the fount of patriarchal love, and he wants to know not only if he's loved for himself, but how much is he loved. So he divides his kingdom into three parts. His two elder daughters flatter him extravagantly and receive their share. But Cordelia, the third daughter, even though she loves him, stubbornly refuses to play his game. In rage, he marries her off to the King of France and banishes her with these words, "Thou hast her, France, let her be thine, for we have no such daughter, nor shall ever see that face of hers again." From that point, the play descends breathlessly from crisis to catastrophe. The daughters reject their father and his followers. He's pushed out of their homes, and he's exposed to storm, wind, rain, mud, and cold. Overstretched by an excess of fury and despair, he goes insane. In his madness, for the first time in his life, he starts to feel for the suffering of others. I have ta'en too little care of this. Cordelia eventually returns with an army, and she's reunited with her father. They're reconciled, and he recovers his sanity. His madness hasn't been senile dementia, more a purging of an overload of remorse and pain and anger. Cordelia's army loses in battle with her sisters, and she and her father are taken prisoner. In Act 5, Scene 3, they're dragged off to a cell, and Cordelia shouts wildly at her captors. Shall we not see these daughters and these sisters? But her father calms her. No, 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 no. Come, let's away to prison. We two alone will sing like birds in the cage. When thou dost ask me blessing, I'll kneel down and ask of thee forgiveness. So we'll live and pray and sing and tell old tales and laugh at gilded butterflies and hear poor rogues talk of court news. And we'll talk with them too, who loses and who wins, who's in, who's out, and take upon us the mystery of things as if we were God's spies. And we'll wear out in a walled prison packs and sects of great ones that ebb and flow by the moon. Upon such sacrifices, my Cordelia, the gods themselves throw incense. Have I caught thee? He that parts us shall bring a brand from heaven and fire us hence like foxes. Wipe thine eyes. The good years shall devour them flesh and fell ere they shall make us weep. We'll see them starve first. After all the sound and fury, the violence, the bitterness, the cruelty, there's calm. There's peace. After his invocation of predatory animals, wolves, boars, she-foxes, tigers, vultures, pelicans, serpents and dragons, Lear now conjures up delicate domestic creatures, birds in a cage and gilded butterflies. There's a rueful humour about the way in which he says that he'll kneel to ask forgiveness, and they'll pray together and sing together and laugh. Yes, laugh at overdressed courtiers and their gossip. He speaks with a kind of mild pity, but withholds contempt. We'll talk with them too. What they'll talk of seems startlingly contemporary. Who loses and who wins? Who's in, who's out? He and Cordelia will try to explain the whole world, the mystery of things, as if they were omnipotent operatives, God's spies. He doesn't invoke the mystery of life, or of death, or of nature, but of stuff, the mystery of things, the way the world works. Earlier he'd invoked the terrors of the earth to punish his daughters and called on all shaking thunder to strike flat the thick rotundity of the world. Now he and Cordelia will out-talk and outlast the statesmen and politicians and courtiers whose currency is mere power and fashion. And when you think you can't be more moved by Lear's simple, humane, gentle words, he adds this, upon such sacrifices, my Cordelia, the gods themselves throw incense. She is now his Cordelia. Together they will give up their freedom, and upon that sacrifice, the gods themselves will bless them. Incense is intended to lift prayers towards the gods and to venerate and sanctify them. Lear inverts this. The gods will appreciate the suffering of him and Cordelia and will worship them for it. It's an utterly beautiful yet austere image. The gods, of course, are plural. The world of the play is not a Christian world. It's a pagan one, a world without hope of redemption and without Christ's promise of eternal life after death. Lear's speech moves Cordelia to tears. Me too. Have I caught thee, says Lear, meaning, do I hold you like a bird in my hands? Have I got you back? Have I made you cry? He hugs her, defiant. They can only be parted by a divine flame, like foxes fired from their dens. Don't cry, he says. Our enemies will never be worthy of our tears. There's another scene in the play which always capsizes me. When Cordelia is reunited with her father, he wakes from a coma and imagines she's a ghost. Then, little by little, he surfaces into sanity and she kneels in front of him. He whispers to Kent, do not laugh at me, for as I am a man, I think this lady to be my child, Cordelia. And she says, and so I am. I am. And my heart breaks. When I've directed these scenes, I've always had to adopt the detachment of a surgeon, preserving my objectivity to avoid succumbing to helpless weeping. Of course, Lear and Cordelia are parted by her murder, a violent, vicious, meaningless act of spite which drains Lear of the last of life. As he dies, his last thought is of Cordelia. Look on her, look, her lips, look there, look there. With his last breath, he follows her departing spirit. The play ends with a pile of five corpses. It's a domestic holocaust. Edgar addresses us with these words. The weight of this sad time we must obey. Speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. The oldest have borne most. We that are young shall never see so much, nor live so long. In the quarto, this speech is attributed to the surviving political leader, Albany, and as such, it's a sort of statesman-like broadcast to the nation. In the folio, however, it's Edgar who speaks. He's a scholar who's become hardened by the treachery of his illegitimate brother Edmund, has rescued his estranged father who dies in his arms, has defeated Edmund in single combat, then witnessed the death of the king's entire family. The advice he gives is spontaneous and unjudgmental. Open your heart, speak what you feel. This is the end of time. It's an extraordinary conclusion to his character's journey and to the most remarkable play in the English language. What do we learn from King Lear? That on the rack of this tough world, our fate lies not in others, but in ourselves. It's about being human, no more, no less.